Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2005. This session, Tikkun Olam, Lutherans and Social Justice, presented in the Fireside Room by Kala Suomala, disc number SUK-2005-03. Let's listen in.
Kala Suomala, I teach at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and I teach in the Religion and Philosophy Department. I mostly teach Bible, specifically Old Testament, and I also teach Judaism there. I've got a few handouts here. There you go. This week, what we're taking a look at is the whole idea of tikkun olam, the Hebrew phrase that suggests mending, healing, repairing, or perfecting the world. And looking at the larger issue of what is the role of a faith community, first of all, specifically the Jewish faith community, in its relationship to the wider world. More than that, how much is the faith community supposed to do, and how much in this healing, repairing, perfecting enterprise, and how much is the responsibility of God? So there are a couple things going on there. Yesterday we took a look at the Jewish community in history and the way they've answered this question. Many times in Jewish history over the last 2,000 years, the Jews have not been in a very strong position to impact the world around them. They've been isolated in ghettos, not been permitted citizenship, all kinds of different things. But with the Enlightenment in Europe and emancipation of Jews from ghettos, they were allowed to integrate into wider society. And this idea of tikkun olam really started to flower at that point and blossom in a way that it hadn't before, because Jews, for the first time in a very, very long time, had the opportunity to take on some of this mending, repairing, healing work. Today, what we're going to take a look at is not a rehash of the history so much as taking a look at the intersection between Luther and Luther's writings on vocation and the Jewish idea and practice of tikkun olam. Now, I need to state that I am not a Luther scholar, so many of you may know much more about Luther than I do. I know a little bit more about the tikkun olam side of things. But I think for the whole enterprise of Jewish-Christian relations and Lutheran-Jewish-Protestant relations, this whole idea of looking at what Luther said about the role of the faith community and its relationship to the world is important when we dialogue with the Jewish community, because both communities have something to say about this. We share texts. This text of be a blessing is absolutely key in that. Got a couple more people in here, and as we get going on today, I have a few more I have some handouts. I'll give you those. All right, we'll get to these shortly. I didn't go, just as a side note, I didn't go to the technology forum last night, although perhaps it was directed at me. I came to Holden with too much technology, let me tell you. I've got a printer in my room, and I was playing with color printers today. So maybe I've gone overboard. I think I'm the, my husband and I, we realized as we picked up our stuff from the loading dock here, well, we realized it long before that when we were hauling it through airports to the middle of nowhere, that we had too much stuff on our hands, including a couple laptops, a printer, a projector. Heading out to the wilderness technologically armed. So at any rate, what we're going to take a look at today is the whole idea of where tikkun olam and the idea of vocation meet. A professor at Texas Lutheran University, Norman Beck, who's done a lot in the work in the area of Jewish-Christian relations over the last couple decades, in fact, says that Christians and Jews have a lot to share in this area. All right, and he actually says that the most significant roots of our Lutheran-Christian concept of vocation penetrate the same soil as the Jewish tikkun olam concept. And he says, he's speaking from a Lutheran standpoint, but I think that can be extended to other Christian denominations as well. And he says, especially in the call stories of Abraham, Moses, Elijah, Amos, and still others, especially in the Hebrew Bible, and even going into the New Testament, there's a lot that Jews and Christians share. Those are the same call stories, especially from the Hebrew Bible. All right, we have those same sorts of things. We take be a blessing, or should, as seriously as the Jewish community, all right, when we read that text. Unfortunately, however, Luther scholars and others have noted that the Lutheran understanding of vocation has been often misrepresented or misunderstood. And that whole idea of vocation has been something that Christians have been hashing out for a very, very long time. Just as we talked about on Monday, Jews were trying to hash out what does that command, be a blessing, mean? And a lot of times it is historically conditioned. Christians have had kind of a rocky road of this vocation business. Often the most simplest definition of vocation is that it's tied to one's profession or job, all right? And that's certainly part of it, but that is definitely not the whole picture, all right? And Mark Colden suggests that this limited understanding of one's vocation as being one's job really limits its connection to bigger goals such as justice, service to one's neighbor, and even partnership with God. If you think of vocation as the job you go to every day and stop it there, then a lot of those bigger goals in terms of relationship to the wider world are really not factoring into it, all right? So, but he says that limiting vocation to one's job is really not what Luther was talking about. He said that was part of it, but not the whole thing, all right? In fact, this limiting of one's vocation to one's job, he says, defining vocation as occupation allows us to restrict it largely to self-serving actions, and even justify our modern irresponsible conformity. It's a pretty tough statement, pretty tough charge. Luther's understanding of vocation at his own time was very controversial. It's not like everybody jumped on and understood it immediately and jumped on board and said, oh, that's the way we gotta go. It really got a lot of people in the church hierarchy frustrated and angry with Luther, and a lot of the laity were perplexed at what he was talking about, because in some ways it seemed fairly radical. In looking again at vocation in Luther's writings, it turns out that Luther's highest criterion for vocation was, in fact, the neighbor in need. Direct connection to our tikkun olam idea, the neighbor in need. Right. So as one's job contributed to service to the other, the neighbor in need, that was key. Luther goes on to say, even the neighbor with the greatest need is at the center of vocation. All right. Take a look. I have on your sheets two sections. All right. Turn it. At the bottom, it says Luther's position. I've got some statements. But at the bottom of that first page where it talks about where Jews and Christians meet, there's a little section where it says Luther's position, and it goes on to the second page. Here's one key passage that I've encountered in taking a look at Luther's work. And this is from his text, The Freedom of a Christian. A man does not live for himself alone, but he lives also for all men on earth. Rather, he lives only for others and not for himself. To this end, he brings his body into subjection that he may the more sincerely and freely serve others. All right? It's amazing when you take a look at that, how the parallels that you see within the Tikkun Olam. Now, you can flip the page, and Luther based that statement on his study of Galatians. And this is where Paul writes, for you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters, only do not use your freedom for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so Luther's taking a look at some of those sorts of things, all right? He talks about the center of Christian living being found in the complex reality of Christian freedom, where one is both Lord of all and servant of all at the same time. So freedom for Luther is not freedom from something, but rather freedom for something. It's not an escapism sort of freedom. It's not a freedom to run away from one's problems, but it is a freedom and a gift to be able to take on other sorts of things.
Maybe we're only playing with words, but what do you do with the word avocation as you define vocation?
Avocation, what do you mean by that when you think about that?
Well, I'm asking you.
Well, I guess I'm just taking a look at Luther's vocation talk in terms of their simple vocare, the Latin, to be called into something, and the way it has been misrepresented. I think that Luther is much more about a wider definition of vocation involving avocation, and that a lot of times in history people have limited it to a simple single-dimensional sort of thing. But I think what Luther was trying to do was to expand that into other areas and to bring in all of one's life, interests, passions, gifts, and that sort of thing. So I think that that's, but what I'm saying at first is that I think that a lot of times people have kind of reduced it to the lowest common denominator, but in fact that's not what it was intended to do, right? So that it was involving that larger sense.
By definition, did Luther have any avocation?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know if other people can answer that. What are you thinking when you say that?
Did play golf or photography or?
Yeah, you know, I think he did. He certainly did. He enjoyed life, and when he talked about life and living in the abundance of life. He enjoyed people. He certainly enjoyed food. He talks a lot about food. He talks a lot about beer, but he talks about learning. He talks about a lot of different things that he really enjoyed doing. That's why I say passions, interests, all of those are part of this package.
Music.
Right? Music, definitely. Yeah, exactly. So Luther had a lot of interests. He was not somebody who was, I guess you could say, focused all the time on, you know, just one sort of thing. He really enjoyed his friends, people, his family, all that sort of thing. So I don't know that he would have called them hobbies in the way we would today, but they were part, because I think they're more to his life. He certainly had those interests that emerge in his writings. And when you take a look at some of the biographies of Luther, they talk about a lot of these wider interests, these avocational interests that he had. So, and I think he's bringing that into this picture as well. When we take a look at this whole idea of vocation and Luther, Luther goes on to say that, and if you can take a look at that second quote under Galatians, and looking at the creation of humans, he also goes back to the Genesis 1. In these sessions, we've been looking a lot at Genesis this week, in the Bible study, Genesis 1 and 2. And even in looking at Tikkun Olam and then Genesis 12 with Abraham. But Luther notes that, and this is really striking because it's very similar to Jewish rabbinic interpretation. Luther notes that the world is God's good creation, not only in terms of its original coming into being, but especially in terms of God's ongoing creative work in upholding and directing all that is and in constantly doing new things. And the rabbis had this sense of the world as not a completed work, and that that God was a creative God, and being created in the image of God, we are endowed with creative capacities to do new and remarkable and creative sorts of things. And a lot of times the object or the goal of those creative things should be to help or accompany our neighbor and the larger world around us. So it's kind of creativity that sort of innovation with a goal that Luther talks about, and very similar in many ways to what the rabbis would say about that. Take a look at the next quote. All right. Luther goes on to show, and this has been emerging this week, what is the human responsibility in this enterprise, and what is God's responsibility in this healing or repairing or perfecting the world. And the rabbis, and as we've been talking about, often allude to some sort of partnership with God. Sometimes they're more bold and they put more on humans, sometimes less bold and they put more responsibility on God. But take a look at what Luther says about this partnership. God could rule the church through the Holy Spirit without the ministry, but he does not want to do this directly. Therefore, he says to Peter, feed my sheep, go preach, baptize, absolve. In the state, he says to the magistrate, watch, defend, use the sword, etc. Therefore, Paul calls the apostles fellow workmen with God. To be sure, he alone works, but he does so through us. Luther backtracks a little bit, saying, you know, God certainly could do all of this, but God chose not to. And that's very similar to one of the rabbinic interpretations of Genesis 12, 2 and 3, where God commands Abraham, be a blessing, in that the rabbis say, well, you know, God formerly was responsible for doing the blessing, in earlier times, but now God is passing the baton, so to speak, to Abraham and Abraham's descendants to take on that job of doing the blessing. Very similar to what Luther says here. Feed my sheep, preach, baptize, absolve, watch, defend, use the sword is a little tricky there, but it's certainly part of this, all right? Fellow workmen with God. Right? So you have some sorts of things where Luther really sees humans in active partnership with God. It's kind of an interesting possibility there. Later in Freedom of the Christian, and this is the last paragraph on that Luther section, Luther notes that every human being has a vocation. Luther asks facetiously at one point, how is it possible that you are not called? And he goes on to say, every man, woman, child, you know, son, daughter, every person is endowed with such a vocation. And it doesn't stop there. He says, in fact, each person has more than enough of what he or she needs in faith to live and thrive, and has, in fact, a surplus, such that we should devote all our works to the welfare of others. Right. Kind of going back to this relationship to the wider community, you can see that Luther and the rabbinic tradition work from those early passages in Genesis, creation and the calling of Abraham, and they both see some similar sorts of things in those passages. Right? And I think it's kind of interesting to see those similar connections. Do people know of other connections or other passages from Luther that you could suggest that would be equally applicable to this? Or any comments, ideas on these passages?
Do you have any sense whether, it strikes me sometimes how even modern Roman Catholics talk about vocation. Mm-hmm. Seeming to mean a call into a religious vocation, and people are differentiated as to whether they're religious or not religious,
right.
etc. I assume that was already true at Luther's time, and it's part of what Luther is doing here, trying to enlarge the sense of calling against maybe a Roman Catholic Church that did not see calling in the temporal world or into non-specific church relations?
I think that's exactly right. You know, when he talks about the priesthood following Paul, the priesthood of all believers, and really emphasizing that, saying this, that one calling, and he does still say, you know, there is calling into ministry, into word and sacrament. However, that is not more significant or more important than the person who takes out our trash. That each, in its own way, is significant, and that God calls people to different things. But I think you're exactly right, trying to extend from, in his own time, from a more limited sense to a definition that would include everybody. All right, and it's kind of interesting the way I started out today that historically Lutherans and other Christians have tried to reduce that definition again over time. You know, where there's that sense, if you can push it off onto one small category, then maybe it won't affect me. You know, it's kind of a human tendency, I wonder, because it's like if you can kind of isolate it and box it in so it's not all-encompassing, then it's a lot more convenient, all right? We like to, you know, simple, you know, it's just like, okay, it's my job, then I don't, have, you know, and not think further beyond that, all right? But it's kind of an interesting human tendency to want to kind of reduce and shrink and, you know, push aside a little bit so we're not having that daily impact, that in-your-face sort of sense to it. Other reactions to some of Luther's statements and on this whole idea of human activity in the world compared to perhaps.
Did he realize that he had such parallels with the rabbinical interpretations, or did they?
I don't know that he did.
Because I know later in his life he was quite anti-Semitic.
Yeah, it doesn't look like some of his biblical scholarship may have had some connections in the Jew, you know, and he may have known there, but he lived near Jews on some occasions. But it doesn't look like he had a lot of interaction with them. And in some ways, some of these writings, I think he probably would have perhaps been more horrified to know that there was such a connection, because I think in a lot of ways, he was very concerned, particularly throughout his career, about bringing Jews over, you know, from their side to the right side, you know, and hoping that they would see the light. And so I think that seeing such parallels, I think he might have been a little bit concerned, more concerned, because often he wanted to differentiate between the old and the new sort of thing. And that's putting it in a nutshell. But yeah, I've asked some Luther scholars about this, about how much interaction he might have had with Jews. And many of them aren't able to say a lot. And they, for the most part, they don't think that he had a lot of interaction. So, and that, but you know, part of it's an argument from silence. We simply don't have a lot of information on that. Other reactions?
I have a Jewish friend with whom we always have these friendly discussions and arguments, and he says, well, you know, you Lutherans talk about faith producing works. He said, I'm still looking for the works. So we start out with works, and that will eventuate in faith. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting, you know, if we expand our understanding of vocation, then we'll say that faith without works is going to be dead, if we only use the faith works language.
Right.
And the two are too intimately connected.
Yeah, I think it's that, you know, that James debate
right.
sort of business that jumps into, that emerges in the conversation. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea of what faith in fact is, I don't think that Luther could have envisioned a faith that wasn't active. And perhaps that's one of the things that we're taking a look at. If you take a look at some of the New Testament texts in terms of this issue of the relationship between faith and action, or faith and resources, there's the key passage that is always perhaps used in Stewardship Sundays that says, where your treasure is, there is your heart, not the other way around. It's almost that works first. You put forth your resources, your heart, your faith will follow those in some ways. You know, and I think so we do have some balance in our text that suggests that. But I think that is that, you know, especially when we try to put those two and see them as two entirely different things, that's perhaps what gets us into a little bit of trouble once in a while on that issue.
The other thing that helps me at least, I think it's interesting, there's a little book many years ago written by, I think, a Norwegian, Einar Billing, called Our Calling. And he says for Luther, the key, it's like a wheel, a wagon wheel. At the center is the forgiveness of sins.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sets us free to serve our neighbor in all of these other areas.
Yeah, like that when he talks about the freedom of a Christian in terms of not freedom from, but freedom for. So it's not just an empty, aimless freedom. Mm-hmm. Because in that aimless freedom really, I guess, isn't freedom. It's, I guess, confusion. And a lot of us experience that too. But yeah, I think that's what you're taking a look at. Who had another?
Oh, parallelism to this, each person has more than enough that he needs in faith to live and so forth. There's a good parallelism to that in Gary Zukav's book, Seat of the Soul, where he says, if you think of God as the ocean, and each individual taking a dip, a cup out of that, you know, you're the same as the ocean, so therefore you should have enough faith to do anything you need to do.
That's a lot of times the water images of pool sort of thing. Actually, we talked a little bit about that on Monday, where the rabbis said perhaps the Jewish community is like they're playing, doing a word play on berecha and beracha, blessing and pool. And they said perhaps the Jewish people are to be a pool or a pond from which others can come to drink and cleanse themselves and bring themselves, or you know, find themselves closer to God. But it's not quite the example that you're bringing up, but similar sorts of you know, unlimited amounts of resources, and when sometimes water images are used to do that. Yeah, it's interesting. Other reactions or comments on some of these writings? Let's take a look then, just for a moment, flip the page. What I did was take some current statements in the last year or so from different Jewish congregations, and I've done a segment, a different range of them. First of all is the Statement of Principles for Reform Judaism. It was adopted at the 1999 Pittsburgh Convention and the Central Conference of American Rabbis. And in that, this is their segment on Tikkun Olam. Here it suggests, they call for Jews to be partners with God in Tikkun Olam, or repairing the world. We are called to help bring near the Messianic age. We seek dialogue and joint action with people of other faiths in the hope that together we can bring peace, freedom, and justice to our world. We are obligated to pursue tzedek, or justice and righteousness, and to narrow the gap between the affluent and the poor, to act against discrimination and oppression, to pursue peace, to welcome the stranger, to protect the earth's biodiversity and natural resources, and to redeem those in physical, economic, and spiritual bondage. Is this a part of a mission statement that could be applicable in your particular congregation or denomination? Is this something that would fly? Or does your congregation have some of these statements as part of the congregation?
You make a good mission statement, I think.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Right.
It's kind of interesting that you can take this from the major Reform Jewish body that was recently adopted and say, wow, this works. This works for me.
This is a little more pointed too, and more specific, I think, than probably the current mission statement of our church.
Okay. Yeah, and this is, you know, since it's a larger church body, I guess it could be equivalent then like to the ELCA or the Presbyterian USA or something like that. But still, yeah, it's a chunk, and they focus on this Tikkun Olam and have actually strengthened it since their first Pittsburgh conference, which was in the 1880s. And there have been a couple since then. They've continued to strengthen this language and try to make it more specific.
I was thinking just of my own church, and I don't know about the overall.
But in your own church, and I think a lot of times it could. So you think it could fit well into your own church?
Yeah.
Other people, do other people's faith communities perhaps have language like this in their mission statements?
Definitely.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it fits exactly. And we've recently had a new pastor in the last couple of years, and it's been so exciting watching those pieces be put in, and everyone's fine with them. They just have never put them in the mission statement. So it's nice when these sorts of things are defined and put right out there.
And thought about and said, this we believe, and this is what we're committed to.
Right.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting that there are such, you know, we talk to our neighbors of other faith traditions, Jews, Muslims, particularly Jews in this case. Other Muslim communities have strong statements as well, but it's amazing how much we can agree on in that statement. In fact, you think, they did a pretty good job. I could maybe just do some cut and pasting when you think about it. Is there anything in this part on Tikkun Olam that strikes you as being particularly significant or something that would be a good addition to your community's mission statement?
The middle part.
The middle one.
The dialogue, seek dialogue and join action with people of other faiths. Mm-hmm. That's especially important since 9/11, I think.
Right.
We've got a lot of people in the Muslim world that are being disenfranchised because of their faith.
And so it's talking about dialogue and joint effort, which I think is really important. Not just talking to our neighbor, but working with our neighbor.
Yeah.
And both of them kind of going hand in hand. Right. Yeah. Other sorts of statements that you think would find a good home in your community.
I do have a comment about that, though.
Uh-huh.
If I'm not mistaken, the Jewish church has splits within it, or the Jewish faith has splits within it, just like the Lutheran faith does.
Right.
It just cracks me up that we can't even get it together on the denominational level. But yet we all have this you know, over umbrella goal that we'll interact with other faiths, and we can't even just make it work in people within our tradition.
Yeah.
You know, it is kind of interesting in talking to our Jewish brothers and sisters in dialogue when we engage in this sort of thing at a national level and we meet together. It's so interesting when they come and we say, so, and part of the, we engage in some formal dialogue as an ELCA panel at least about every year, every other year. And it's usually a two-day deal. And we get together, and a lot of it's informal conversation at first, sort of an agenda. And at first we talk about, you know, we introduce ourselves, where we're from, and there are usually six Lutherans or seven, and then six or seven Jewish members from around the U.S. And one of the first things that we do is talk about, where are you at today in your faith community? What's going on? What are some of the issues? What are some of the good things? What are some of the challenges that you're facing? And I remember my first time in one of these dialogue situations is I found my mouth hanging open saying, that's exactly what we're dealing with. Because somebody was at a seminary and said, you know, we're really dealing with a lot of curriculum reforms issues. What should a seminarian be like today? What sort of tools should a seminarian have? And what kinds of classes and all that sort of thing? I'm like, that's what we're talking about. And they said, and sexuality is an issue. We're talking about that in our congregations. I said, us too. You know, and so a lot of the struggles were similar. And a lot of those sorts of things. And so, yeah, at least in that dialogue setting, we realized it's just like, wow. And if we could talk a little bit more, maybe we could pull some of this together.
The Jewish are kind of unique, though, in the biblical teaching of keeping themselves separate. And I wonder how they're able to reconcile that part, you know, they were not to merge or mingle with other religions.
That is a variation right now in today's specifically American, well, even Israeli Jewish community. There's, like you'd mentioned, there are differences in terms of different groupings. Not as many as you'd find within Protestantism, partly because of numbers. But there are at least a good five or six very active Jewish denominations, Jewish groupings in the United States. Reform Jews are probably on the more liberal side of that, and they correspond more directly to perhaps ELCA Lutheran in terms of their different stance on things. For Reform Jews, isolation is not a part of who they are. Reform Jews, since the very outset, have been set on integrating and being part of the larger world. Now, if you take a look at a Hasidic community on the very much more traditional end, they will be far more isolated. All right, so it depends on the community. And you can think of Christian communities who have that variety of stances too. Can you think of Christian communities who have a very isolated stance?
Mennonites or something like that.
Yeah, I'm thinking where I live in Iowa, I see buggies nearly every day, the Amish.
Amish.
You know, and that's perhaps one extreme, but there are other Christian communities who tend to be very isolated too. So yeah, it's kind of, but you have that range, is what I'm saying, within Judaism. And I think a core part of Reform identity is to integrate into society. That was part of the Reform statement, but then I took a look at some individual synagogue statements. And I've got a Reform synagogue, a Reconstructionist synagogue, and a Conservative synagogue, and different approaches to these sorts of things. Brooklyn Heights Reform Synagogue states simply in its mission statement about work to improve the world is an essential part of our spirituality. and they are more specific congregationally in this sort of thing. Since 1983, Brooklyn Heights Reform Synagogue has housed a homeless shelter and volunteer cooks and staff. We have an active social justice program aimed at the larger Jewish and non-Jewish communities, with activities ranging from helping recent Russian immigrants learn English and adjust to life in the U.S. to holding a holiday toy, book, and coat drive for the December holiday season. Now, that's kind of interesting. What strikes you about that statement? This is a Reform synagogue, part of their self-description and mission statement that you can find on the web.
Because the interaction with non-Jews.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? They have that as part of their statement, that it's to Jews and non-Jews. What sorts of activities are surprising to you in terms of engagement?
The holiday stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. They are very much involved. My first Christmas in Cincinnati, Ohio, when I was in grad school, we worked with the Lutheran Church in the inner city of Cincinnati, in an area neighborhood called Over the Rhine, and we got a Christmas breakfast program up and running because it's a very poor neighborhood, and so we opened the doors of the church having no idea if we'd have 7 or 170 people join us for breakfast. And so we put out the call for volunteers. Well, we got synagogues coming in to help us. And somebody asked them, you know, does this make you uncomfortable? They said, no, we're feeding people. We can join together in that. And so we had this Jewish youth group on the corner singing Christmas carols with us. Now that kind of, you know, that what a you know, you kind of think about that. That's interesting. Now, with that, the first statement that we took a look at from the Reform larger movement, you know, there's a lot we could do. Now, the second statement from Brooklyn Heights Synagogue, is this something that your congregation engages in?
Yes.
To this extent. Can you give an example?
Oh, one example would be the quilts.
Great.
And the baby layouts. And so, housing the homeless.
So to any community or any person who is in need.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So there are some things like that, so you can kind of see some parallels there. Other communities that have some of these same sorts of goals and put this sort of energy into the community beyond them.
Well, we have a food bank, and we house the Lutheran Refugee Service, which serves Russian immigrants. That just jumped out.
Oh, that's great!
Plus, we have Christmas baskets and gifts and all of that, and
okay,
ongoing 12-step program. That we host like 15 12-step groups.
Yeah, so housing regardless. And I think that this is an issue for churches. How much do you serve your own community and how much do you serve the outside community? Jewish synagogues face that same balance and same issue. They say there's always this issue of balance in congregations. How much is internally should be internally directed, how much should be externally directed? And congregations, I don't know if you are active in making those decisions, but there are always people that say, well, and the food pantries that I've been involved in, well, are any of those people that are being served by the food pantry, are they showing up at church? You heard that one. You know, and I think that when in this setting, it doesn't look as if they're requiring that or asking anybody to necessarily, you know, saying that you need to show up and worship with us to receive. But I think that's a battle in our churches. In the town where I live, there is a Lutheran church. The church that I have has a food pantry open to the community. It's a joint community effort. Down the street is another Lutheran church that has a food pantry. It is not available to the community. It's an internal food pantry.
Oh, no.
That's
weird.
Yeah, I said, okay. So, you know, you try to figure these things out. You can see on the same street, two Lutheran churches struggling with this issue of balance. Should it be internal? Should it be external? Because the complaints in our church are, shouldn't we be helping our own? And the answer is yes. Shouldn't we be helping the other? Yes. And how much resources, a lot to those sorts of things?
Living overseas for 7 years, as we have been, I learned the difference between an embassy and a consulate. I've never had that figured out. And I know, and of course, Apostle Paul uses a lot of ambassadorial language in talking about the nature of the church. And the difference, essentially, as I figured it out, is that an embassy reaches out to the country. A consulate serves one's own citizens. So you go to the consulate, get your passport, extend this.
Something has happened, a legal issue, yeah?
But the embassy is that which has relationships within the wider community, and I fear that too many of our churches are consulates.
That's a fantastic image. Wow. So having that kind of set up as both
to serve expatriates from our own country as they are residing in this locale,
and as their issues emerge,
yeah.
Which is important. Yeah. If you needed the services of a consulate, they can be a lifesaver. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, though, if it's simply that, with no embassy there,
then you're not impacting the place where you are. You're in survival mode.
But that's the interesting difference between service and outreach. Your mm-hmm. ambassadors are outreach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. Very a lot of Lutheran churches, they serve, but there isn't significant outreach.
What do you mean by outreach?
As in terms of evangelism. Mm-hmm. I mean, we say that in our name, but how many of us go door to door? Or would feel comfortable going door to door?
Or, yeah, and so there's that issue of outreach and service, and how connected are they? Or are they part of the same package? Or do you link them and say, if we serve you, you need to, you know, we need you to also be part of our, you know, worship or our part of our community? Yeah, it's a tricky question. How much of both, what kind of balance should there be? Because within that embassy office, then you need some further sorts of examination of what's going on out there. And maybe perhaps that's been the problem. They have been completely separated over the years. We have outreach activities and then something that we call service. Perhaps we could integrate them more.
No, because in some sense, if given our context, if outreach meant then going out into the Slovak community to invite them to our consulate to become Americans, I mean, something really problematic
would not have a good outcome.
Yeah.
Right.
We've had something interesting happen in our church. A few years ago, the pastor we had at the time wanted to do more outreach and have the church be involved in the greater community. So we joined this group called Isaiah. It's part of the, I think, Gamaliel. Is that, can anybody know what that is? Anyway, they formed in conjunction with other churches in the area to try to impact legislation for homelessness, immigration, and our church especially with education.
Okay.
In Minnesota, in the Twin City area, we have been having a lot of trouble getting enough funds. And so our church made quite a large donation. They used a couple of people for staff time, gave them staff time to get involved in this project, and they had some huge impact in the community and in the legislation this last go-round. But there is a large segment of our congregation that is very angry about that. And so it's going to be a real divisive thing. You know.
Yeah, and I think that you see that in a lot of the congregations when you talk to rabbis, they say, you know, the things like that, they say the exact same sort of issues emerge in their congregations. The exact same sorts of things. What kind of balance do you keep? Mm-hmm. All right. So it's a tricky, tricky thing. Where do you think the anger comes from?
Well, part of it is that we're using church money that we could be spending on other things for engaging with other churches in the community. We're using staff time that could be used for other things.
Okay.
And also the fact that we're engaged with a lot of Catholic churches, and that's seen as kind of frightening. We pray together.
Oh dear. Yeah, you know, some of these interesting things, you know, churches have a really funny dynamic in them. I heard from a pastor of a church who they were told they were going to receive some sort of benefit on the death of one of their older members who hadn't been around for quite a long time, you know, was in a nursing home. This person died, and they expected, you know, maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand dollars at best.
So at a council meeting, they said, okay, this should go to community charity. You know, well, what turns out is that the money came in, and it was actually closer to $100,000. The council came back and said, because they agreed the whole amount, and it was, the council met again and said, well, we can't possibly give it to charities now that we know it's this much. We can't afford to give it away. Yeah, isn't it a tricky thing? Isn't it a tricky thing?
Well, therefore, to go back to that last Luther statement, it's interesting to me that he says each person has more than enough of what he or she needs in faith to live and thrive, and has in fact a surplus. Now, it's interesting to me to contemplate that. That's really kind of a theology of abundance.
Mm-hmm.
And if Luther already had that sense, and did that mean that also there was sufficient material abundance at that time so that people did not feel need or whatever?
Well, I think among some members, but I think there's a lot of poverty. I think that though maybe he was dealing with that same issue. Our tendency is to think, oh, I only have enough for myself. Mm-hmm. Kind of goes back to the feeding of 5,000 issue, and Luther saying, in faith, we do have a lot more than we think we have. And as free Christians, if we can let it flow a little, amazing things can happen. You know, and that's hard for us to get our heads around.
And then I think if Luther were to look at our context and our situation, I mean, never in all of human history has ever a people had such great abundance as we have, and such obvious, visible potential connection with the rest of the world. Never has communication been of such a nature.
Exactly.
That there is one.
You know, I wonder, it would have been nice if we could have visitors from the past once in a while for Luther to have visited that congregation with a large endowment. And when they said, we can't possibly afford to give it all away. You know, interesting. Did you have a
call? Well, I was just going to say that was the foundation for this Isaiah project, is that we have such abundance, and legislators keep saying, we don't have the money
right,
to buy books and stuff, but that was their underlying theology or philosophy, that we have abundance.
That we have, yeah, it's kind of interesting. It seems as if, and it's, you know, when you take a look at the Tikkun Olam idea, that sense that every person has unique abilities, gifts, resources to bring to the table. There's enough. Operating from a theory of, you know, surplus as opposed to deficit. Kind of a different sort of thing. You know, how do you operate then? And it's kind of an interesting take on it. Let's take a look at the Adat Shalom Reconstructionist Congregation. It's in Bethesda, Maryland. And they state, it should define some terms here, some of you may know this, mitzvah simply means commandment, all right, it's a Hebrew word. The mitzvah of Tikkun Olam, or the commandment to perfect or repair the world, obliges us to help alleviate hunger, homelessness, disease, ignorance, abuse, and political oppression among all people. In addition, we have a responsibility to preserve the health of the global ecosystem upon which all life depends. We're going to be talking a little bit more about that on Friday, but you notice in two of these statements now that you have mention of the environment and the larger, the, you know, taking into account more of what makes up this world. Anything in that statement strike you as being different than what we've read before, or significant additions?
Ignorance is one of those things.
Ignorance. And they take, and Jewish communities are very often committed to education. They see education as a real goal. For those of you who were here last night, I mentioned that I myself am a product of this Jewish education enterprise. I did my PhD at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, the central school for reform rabbinical training. And after World War II, they established a program there for Christian fellows. It was only men then. And they expanded it shortly after that to a PhD program where Christians and Jews could study together and with each other and learn from each other, and to alleviate ignorance, which they saw as a key cause of the Holocaust. So, you know, and this, but that takes resources to alleviate ignorance. We all know that. This is not a free sort of thing.
And one of the disappointing things for me in our society now is there's a huge emphasis on being suspicious about education and minimizing what education does, mm-hmm. narrowing it.
Can you think of some examples of that specifically?
Well, not funding tax initiatives for programs in public education, for music, for arts and
language,
vocational training.
Well, and not only that, but special education for children of need. You know, handicapped children or children that can't learn. Mm-hmm. All those resources are being pulled all the time and getting less and less.
Maybe we're operating from that deficit perspective.
So people don't want to pay to help those children and families who have tremendous learning problems in terms of getting to the level of independence as an adult. Mm-hmm. So we're building in more handicapped people in adulthood.
First, a reflection on that. Capitalism, or at least advertising, is dependent on a deficit mm-hmm. perspective. Yes.
You don't have enough, and we have something that will help you.
Yeah, and if you don't have this, somehow or other, you're insufficient, mm-hmm. etc. But another point I want to make is, I was interested to learn just a month ago that at Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, there are 5 Turkish Muslim students, and there's going to be an additional
cohort that's coming in this fall.
Yeah.
Yes, I talked to the people there, and it's a really remarkable thing in that community. The Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, one of the ELCA seminaries, is a developing Islamic program, and also they have now 5 Turkish Muslim students participating in the master's program.
Coming there for a master's degree from the Lutheran School of Theology.
But those are some really significant sorts of ventures, you know, in terms of, and part of the reaction, I'm sure, among donors is, why should we fund Turkish Muslims when we can't fund our own students? You know, that's always, but there's some value. There's a huge amount of value in extending ourselves beyond our comfort zones.
Not the same question about spending money to bomb Muslims.
Oh,
that's
yes.
Do you have any idea how that Maryland congregation or temple carries out their mission statement?
You know, I did take a look at some of their other website sorts of things where they talk about specific parts of their ministry. Some of them, they operate with programs like Doctors Without Borders and Partners in Health in disease issues, both in the United States as well as in the world. Free clinic sorts of things. And education programs, after school programs for people in the neighborhood, not just their own families. So those are some of the sorts of things that I noticed. But they kind of have this described, and then they have different aspects of how they show what they're doing. And I don't think they carry out all these things simultaneously. I don't think they're that big. But they try to, you know, keep an updated sort of thing. But yeah, sometimes some congregations, like you were talking about, would focus more on one area at a time, perhaps education or medical care or, you know, different things. Some of the smaller congregations or even larger ones would try to pick an area to, you know, for their resources.
Carla, how does a Reconstructionist congregation differ from a Reform?
A Reconstructionist congregation, Reconstructionist Judaism emerged in the 1920s in the United States, and it has perhaps a more humanistic impulse even than Reform. It's much smaller than Reform, so focusing on Jewish, perhaps some Jewish ritual, but very much focused on humanity and the good of humanity. All right, so it's kind of, that sort of makes sense when you take a look at there. And so in some cases you'd find Reconstructionist Jews, I guess it's the same with Reform, who would say they don't necessarily believe in God, but they are Jews. And as Jews, this is their responsibility.
Do they live side by side with the more conservatives?
Liberal. They're more liberal Jews. Yeah, Reconstructionist and Reform would be closer to each other. And actually, you know, in the last few years, conservative has, you know, it's now getting much harder to distinguish, especially between Reform and conservative. I asked a friend of mine, a rabbi, who serves a congregation that's both Reform and conservative, and I asked him, I said, so what's the difference? Now, you got to lay this out on the line. I said, I've read everything, and I know there's some, he said, and I said, you know, in terms of how it works itself out in your congregation, he goes, the prayer book. On Friday night, we use the Reform prayer book. On Saturday morning, we use the conservative, and everybody's happy. So, you know, because a lot of social issues that had separated them before, like the ordination of women, the conservative group now does ordain women since 1982, and the Reform started in the early 70s. So some of those sorts of things brought them closer together. Let's take a look at the Lasting Temple of Aaron. This is in the Twin Cities. I actually had the privilege to tutor in their Jewish school there, little kids learning Hebrew for Bar and Bat Mitzvah. The Temple of Aaron suggests that their goal, their mission of, they have actually a Tikkun Olam committee. And that goal is to educate and engage Temple of Aaron members in community-based action to build a better world, Tikkun Olam. Through service projects, advocacy, and organizing, Temple of Aaron's Tikkun Olam Social Action Committee will ensure that social justice is an integral part of the synagogue's mission. So this each community they looked at was set up slightly differently in the way they approached the Tikkun Olam sort of thing, but this Temple of Aaron is a pretty substantial community in the Twin Cities, and they have a committee that works to do these things. And it doesn't mean they're the only ones doing it, but they try to organize it and help ensure that the entire congregation is educated and informed about issues and objectives, things like that. All right. We just have a minute or so left. I'd like to have you flip again to the other side where it says ideas that we might consider. It's on the bottom part. All right. These are some of the things that kind of sum up where Jews and Christians might come to the table and talk about some of these things. Judaism has generally maintained a very positive expectation of what the world can and should be, and has maintained that a perfected world is possible in history, meaning in real time, I guess, if you could use that phrase, not in some sort of distant place. All right. And again, we have to be careful when we use the word perfect. And try to go back to that. Perfect, in the way that it's defined, is not necessarily a world free of all problems. It's a world that uses its resources wisely to solve those problems and is able to do so. All right? So a perfect world is not a seamless one, necessarily. Keep that in mind when you're thinking about that term. In their understanding of Tikkun Olam, Judaism has the sense that the ability and desire to improve the world is part of our very makeup as humans. And we talked about Luther saying each and every one of us has not only enough, but more than enough to do that. The relationship between God and human beings has the potential to be very rich within the framework of Tikkun Olam. We can be instruments of, partners with, or even co-creators with God. Great hope and expectation is placed on human potential. Now, often Christians get a little bit anxious at this, but looking at some of Luther's work, where Luther describes it saying, hey, God could have run the whole show. God chose not to. God handed over that sort of position of partnership, workmen with God. So in some ways, when we take a look at the biblical text and then other Christian commentators, there is a lot more in common there than Christians sometimes think upon first reaction. The work of Tikkun Olam demands attention to the balance in our communities between internal and external concerns, from self to other. And that's kind of what we spent some time talking about. How do you balance those two sorts of things? And I think Jews and Christians would have a lot to talk about there and have a lot in common. How do you balance? How does your community? Well, ours has been doing this, and we've run into some challenges in this area, and I think it's a real fruitful area of discussion, partly because it's always an issue. The work of Tikkun Olam is also flexible. It adapts to the very specific realities of history, perhaps in order that those realities might be changed. As I talked about yesterday, Jews in a large chunk of history didn't have necessarily the opportunity to engage in Tikkun Olam to the extent that they would have desired, or that they could have, partly because of other realities imposed upon them. Maybe it's part of the work of Tikkun Olam to help change those sorts of realities and work together. Finally, the work of Tikkun Olam is universal in its invitation. Everyone is called to be part of the work of Tikkun Olam. And I think that Luther could stamp that one with an amen. You know, and he says, every person, and you can see that Luther constantly is to always talk, the priesthood of all believers, every person, all humankind. He uses that universal language a lot, as does the practice and idea of Tikkun Olam. So it's kind of, so you see a lot of areas where I think Tikkun Olam and Luther's sense of vocation could be pulled together. I think maybe the biggest difference on this list is the first one, in terms of a very positive expectation of the world. I come from a very pietistic Lutheran tradition where there wasn't much hope or expectation for the world. My grandmother was a Finnish pietist who thought that she was passing through and hoped to get on to the better world. And I remember as a three-year-old, Carla, sometimes you just have to suffer. A true Finnish pietist, you know, but that it's a different view of the world. And I think that Jews have something to offer in saying, hey, you know, we don't necessarily know how the future will unfold. This is what we've got. Maybe we should take care of it. And, you know, not try to make such a distinct break between this world and something that's supposedly better off in the future. Because a lot of times that gives Christians an excuse to say, well, we don't need to worry about this one. A better one's coming up. It's okay if we don't do much. And I think that might be one of the areas where Christians and Jews perhaps look at the structure of the world, the universe, in perhaps a slightly different way, and might be able to learn a little bit from each other there. Because I think if you say, this is the world we've got, it might be around for a long time, this might in fact be the world we've got to work with to make perfect, we might approach things a little differently. Any last comments?
I think it's interesting to read the Jewish mission statements and think of what we have in our own Lutheran churches, where hidden, or not even hidden many times, will be a comment that we want the whole world to be Christian. Well, no, Lutheran. Nothing about evangelizing. Yeah.
No, proselytism has not been a part of Jewish tradition for a long time, partly because it was illegal for about 1,200 years in Europe, through most of Europe, and even in other countries as well. And so Jews kind of got out of the habit of proselytism.
Which makes it a lot different in how we approach our role.
It does. That's an excellent proselytism and our role towards gaining converts. Although it has been part of Jewish tradition, at present it does not play that kind of role that it does in some Christian denominations.
When was it part of Jewish?
Probably, taking a look at the early centuries of the Common Era, the first century, even the century or two before that, it looks as if Judaism was a rapidly growing proselytizing religion throughout Greece, into the Greek part of Egypt, in and around the Mediterranean world. It looks as if there were quite a few converts, and that Jews were actively setting up synagogues and bringing in others.
Isn't proselytizing kind of a concept that almost has to be re-looked now when the world is so integrated globally, because it's not appropriate to proselytize certain others, or at least not on their turf.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of become tricky in the last number of years. I also think that proselytism is difficult because it happens on so many different levels. My husband's first parish was in a small town in Indiana, and there just was a range of Christian churches. We didn't have an other, you know, that sort. And proselytism there was what the pastors called sheep stealing. You go and recruit members from other congregations to fill your pews, sort of thing. So proselytism kind of goes from going to get other Christians who perhaps don't have enough of the truth to going to the totally other to try to bring them in. So I think it's an ongoing discussion in terms of what that should involve and when.
Right, exactly.
And how.
Right.
What is an ethical way and a responsible way of doing that?
Yes.
And I think that that's something for Christians to definitely consider. What is a responsible? And not to say that it shouldn't be part of it. It certainly should. If you've got good news, you should share it. But if it turns into news that isn't good, then yeah, I think there need to be some concerns raised. Yeah, it's tricky. I haven't seen, in our small town in Indiana, 6,000-7,000 people with everybody going after each other's members. You kind of wonder. Well, thank you very much. Have a good lunch.